It's Thursday, June 12th, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belleville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. Hey, welcome all you beautiful stashers to our Thursday stash. Hey, still unpacking and getting everything put together from the Aspen Legal Seminar that we just had this last weekend. Boy, I tell you, it's my first time in Aspen, Colorado, and what a beautiful, beautiful time it was there. Couldn't have had better weather. A funny little thing happened on our way up there to Aspen. I flew in with Madeline Martinez, who's a new board member and the executive director of Oregon Normal, and her husband and myself. And we were coming back in this van. There was a passenger sitting in the front seat, a blonde woman. And then there was two other women in the back seat. And so we didn't know them either. As we're driving, there's the typical chit chat that you'd get on a closed bus like that. And the women in the back asked what we were there for, and we mentioned that we were here for the Normal Aspen Legal Seminar. And of course, they asked, what's Normal? And I replied, well, that's the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And their reply was, oh. And from that moment on, there was absolutely no small talk left in that van. So it's always interesting to see how the people react when you tell them right up front, without any shame, that you're for the reform of marijuana laws. The stunning irony, of course, is that those two women were in town for a very expensive wine and cheese weekend in Aspen. Yeah, so wine, that's not a problem. Let's get to the podcast today. I'm going to bring you some more presentation from the Aspen Legal Seminar with Paul Armentano, the deputy director of Normal, who is presenting on the latest DUID research that's drugged driving, the latest DUID research that criminal lawyers need to know. You'll get to learn all about the standards for per se and zero tolerance per se driving laws that are popping up all around the country. Also, we're going to do some rock and roll for our musical break today with a band called Scratched Apple and a song called Songs of the Revolution. So sit back and relax with a little pack of loco. It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Oregon Court of Appeals protects medical marijuana. From the Seattle Times. The Oregon Court of Appeals has ruled that an employer must make a reasonable accommodation for medical marijuana use for a disability. In an opinion issued Wednesday, the appeals court upheld a ruling by the State Bureau of Labor and Industries. The agency said that Emerald Steel Fabricators in Eugene violated state laws barring discrimination against the disabled by discharging an employee who used medical marijuana. A key issue was the fact the employee never used marijuana in the workplace, an issue the Oregon Supreme Court avoided in 2006 when it ruled against a registered medical marijuana user fired from his job at a Columbia Forest Products plant after urine tests detected traces of the drug. Employers do not have to let patients smoke medical marijuana in the workplace. But the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, approved by voters in 1998, was unclear about whether employers must accommodate workers who smoke medical marijuana off the job. In the opinion by Judge Timothy Sercom, the Oregon Court of Appeals went back over the 2006 Oregon Supreme Court ruling to emphasize the Emerald Steel employee never used the marijuana at work, just like the worker in the Columbia Forest case. Medical marijuana has been opposed by the construction industry, which wants laws to prohibit medical marijuana users from potentially hazardous jobs, such as operating heavy machinery. Supporters of restrictions on medical marijuana use, including State Representative Mike Schaffler, Democrat from Happy Valley, have said they are trying to ensure public safety. But medical marijuana activist John Sajo says that during legislative hearings last year, nobody was able to identify a single case where a medical marijuana patient had caused a workplace accident or problem. Yes, Representative Schaffler sure had a fun time during testimony from some of us Oregon activists. We printed up flyers accusing Schaffler of instituting job discrimination against the sick and disabled. Schaffler replied that the whole set of the Oregon revised statutes are books full of discrimination. For example, it discriminates against him performing brain surgery or building a 100-foot tower in his yard. When a politician can't tell the difference between reasonable regulations based on public safety and unreasonable regulations designed to discriminate, you know you've got a tough battle on your hands. They think a medical marijuana patient at work is as dangerous as a state representative performing brain surgery. See, Schaffler, like lots of people, think that the medical marijuana patient is going to be running around like Cheech and Chong all the time, hotboxing the cab of the crane or giggling when they notice they've been parked in the bulldozer for the past 20 minutes. They really think we're crazy to, in their mind, put Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High behind the bandsaw at the mill, or put the dude from the Big Lebowski in charge of demolition at the construction site. They really can't see that marijuana should be treated like other medicines, just like it says in the law. They seem to have no issue with the users of heavy prescription drugs. In fact, we brought forth proposals that would actually test for impairment rather than the quality of a worker's urine. That was soundly rejected. Why, it might burden those workers who use Ambien, Xanax, OxyContin, Percocet, Prozac, or even those who just like to knock back a beer or two during lunch. We can only conclude that it's not the impairment they really care about, it's losing their right to fire whom they consider potheads. Schaffler also had a hard time explaining how this was a measure to promote public safety. Since Oregon's medical marijuana law went into effect in 1999, we've seen workplace fatalities remain more or less steady and workdays lost from injuries drop, even as the patient population grew from 600 in 2000 to almost 20,000 today. If medical marijuana users in the workplace are such a hazard, where are the bodies? New study says marijuana potency increases in 2007, from the Associated Press. Marijuana potency increased last year to the highest level in more than 30 years, posing greater health risks to people who may view the drug as harmless, according to a report released Thursday by the White House. The latest analysis from the University of Mississippi's Potency Monitoring Project tracked the average amount of THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, in samples seized by law enforcement agencies from 1975 through 2007. It found that the average amount of THC reached 9.6% in 2007, compared with 8.75% the previous year. The 9.6% level represents more than a doubling of marijuana potency since 1983, when it averaged just under 4%. But when you look under the numbers, though, you find that two-thirds of the samples in this survey are not domestic marijuana. The domestic marijuana potency is at 5%, according to these figures. Plus, these cannabis seizure numbers reflect everything from ditchweed and leaf to sensimilia and hash. I wonder, then, if these reports are worthless when we talk about the domestic cannabis market. Certainly more of the seized marijuana is going to be foreign, because it's going to most likely be seized as it travels into and around our country. The iron law of prohibition always makes a smuggler create more potent drugs to smuggle, so it is no surprise that the domestic weed comes in at 5% and the international at 9%. Marijuana growing, though, is so easily concealed in a home that many people are getting their weed just one or two steps away from a local grower. How many people are smoking much more potent domestic weed that rarely gets seized by police? like that 37.2% THC seizure that topped their list for the quarter. Which is all quite a fascinating argument, except for one small detail. Marijuana's potency is irrelevant. While the drug's potency may be rising, marijuana users generally adjust to the level of potency and smoke it accordingly, said Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who teaches psychology at the State University of New York in Albany and serves as an advisor for marijuana advocacy groups. He said, quote, "Stronger cannabis leads to less inhaled smoke," end quote. A report from the office last month found that a teenager who has been depressed in the past year was more than twice as likely to have used marijuana than teenagers who have not reported being depressed, 25% compared with 12%. The study said marijuana use increased the risk of developing mental disorders by 40%. Yes, the dope drives you insane, reefer madness. What the study didn't even attempt to deduce was whether marijuana causes depression or whether depressed kids self-medicate with marijuana. It also didn't measure whether those with a predisposition to mental disorders tend to smoke marijuana to self-medicate. I just go back to the simple question, where are the bodies? If marijuana is so harmful to the mental development of teens, then why do we not see increases in the rates of teen mental disorders mirroring the increased rates of teen cannabis use or increases in marijuana's potency? Surely by now, we would have seen an effect on the Summer of Love generation, the Me generation, Generation X, the post-medical marijuana generation, all using lots of pot as it gets more and more potent, yet rates of schizophrenia and other mental disorders remain virtually unchanged. Dr. Nora Volkow, director of the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, which funded the University of Mississippi study, said, quote, "The increases in marijuana potency are of concern since they increase the likelihood of acute toxicity, including mental impairment. Particularly worrisome is the possibility that the more potent THC might be more effective at triggering the changes in the brain that can lead to addiction," end quote. But there's no data showing that a higher potency in marijuana leads to more addiction, Earlywine said, and marijuana's withdrawal symptoms are mild at best. Quote, "Mild irritability, craving for marijuana, and decreased appetite. I mean, those are laughable when you talk about withdrawal from a drug. Caffeine is worse," end quote. Kudos to Dr. Mitch for getting his commentary in this Associated Press story. So often these stories are so one-sided when the press quotes the government official, then quotes the law enforcement official, then quotes the scientist who works either for the government or the law enforcement. Rarely do we get one of our acknowledged experts in the mainstream media to defend the truth. Four men invade Big Island home, steal marijuana and cash. From KITV, Honolulu, Hawaii. Four men wearing masks broke into a Keough home Monday and stole marijuana plants and cash, according to Big Island police. It happened at about 3 p.m. in a home in the Hawaiian Paradise Park subdivision. The men demanded cash and marijuana from a 60-year-old man who lived in the home, police said. The man had a permit for medical marijuana. One of the men carried a knife, police said. The victim was not injured. Police said the men were only identified as four local males between the ages of 25 to 30, wearing the masks and long-sleeved shirts. Medical marijuana patients will continue to be at risk of these home invasion arrests so long as the absurd prohibition of cannabis for healthy people remains. The medical marijuana law has never provided for a way for patients to get their medicine, so many grow their own. The bad guys know that. And no, there can be anywhere from $2,400 to $10,000 worth of street weed that they can sell from their heist. Does anyone think we'd be less safe if the marijuana was so readily available in a liquor store that it wouldn't be worth the effort or jail time to threaten and rob a senior citizen?
Stupid Stoner Stories.
As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
Rome police arrested a man at Rome Municipal Court Wednesday when he was found with a baggie of marijuana at the metal detector, reports stated. According to Rome police reports, Angelo Dwayne Harris Jr., age 23, was taken into custody at 2:15 p.m. Wednesday when he emptied his pockets at the metal detector and placed a baggie of marijuana on the conveyor belt for inspection. Police charged Harris with misdemeanor possession of marijuana, and he remains at the Floyd County Jail this morning.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Normal Deputy Director Paul Armentano is one of the country's leading experts on the research about cannabis and driving, and particularly the laws that have sprung up about zero-tolerance drugged driving and per se driving statutes. This is a two-part presentation, just a portion of what he presented at the Normal Aspen Legal Seminar last weekend. You can get the full presentation on video and audio by visiting our homepage at stash.normal.org. Look on the right side for the important stash, and you'll find the link to the Aspen Legal Seminar archive page. This is part one of Paul Armentano's presentation on knowing about the DUID laws. Part two will come right after the musical break.
But that said, over the last few years, DAs and cops and prosecutors have pushed to get away from this standard, and they have wanted to move to a per se standard, or in some cases, a zero tolerance per se standard. Many of you here, I'm sure, are very familiar with per se standards. After all, we have one for alcohol and driving. If a certain amount of alcohol in your blood, you are considered per se to be too impaired to drive. So why don't we have a similar standard like that for illicit drugs or marijuana? Well, there's actually several reasons. The most obvious reason is that, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, and that's in a report, actually, that I brought with me called State of Knowledge of Drug-Impaired Driving. It's actually a great report put up by NHTSA. It's online. A lot of gems, if you're doing this kind of litigation, are in this report. For instance, the acute effects of marijuana on driving dissipate in 1 hour. It's in this report. The U.S. government says that, not me. But this report also says that forensic toxicologists generally have failed to agree on specific per se levels that could be designated as evidence of impairment. That obviously is a problem. If we're trying to talk about a set standard for per se laws regarding marijuana, there are some experts, and specifically there's a paper by Franjo Grotenherm that was published in the journal Addiction just a few months ago, that have suggested possible per se levels for cannabis. And these per se levels regard the amount of THC in a driver's blood. I work with Franjo on quite a number of issues. He's very knowledgeable on this expert on this issue. This is a paper that was authored by a number of experts, actually a who's who in individuals that deal with marijuana and driving. He recommends a standard of possibly 5 to 10 nanograms per milliliter of THC in the blood as a per se standard for impaired driving under the influence of marijuana. I tend to think that is a fairly fair standard when you look at the existing evidence, but this is very preliminary work. In fact, when I began giving this talk about 2 or 3 years ago, there were no papers published on potential per se standards. Now there's about 2 or 3. If we had a 5 to 10 nanogram per milliliter THC blood standard, this would exempt most recreational cannabis users who have not smoked in the past 2 to 3 hours. There's a very good paper that I brought with me by Marilyn Eustis. They give individuals marijuana. They then test their blood every 15 minutes to see what the THC levels are in their blood. They also look at metabolite levels in their blood. They do this for about 6 to 8 hours. We know almost minute by minute how these levels go up, how they go down, and how they correspond to whether those individuals are impaired or not. Marilyn Eustis has done terrific work in this area, and once again, if you're doing litigation on this subject, you need to be familiar with her work. Because believe me, police officers will say things like, I can tell you with certainty that based on this person's blood THC levels, I can tell you the hour they last smoked. Absolutely no way you can't. Marilyn's work makes those people look like idiots when they try to get on the stand and say those things. There's a potential problem with the work of Eustis and some others. And that is when they are looking at the levels of THC and some of these metabolites, they are looking at infrequent, occasional users of marijuana. Most recently, a researcher from Germany and a team from NIDA began looking at, are these levels different when you have very heavy chronic users of marijuana? And in fact, the patterns of when these levels spike and how long it takes these levels to leave a person's system, they are in fact different, even for THC in the blood, which is not something people expected to see. So because of all this, experts do not recommend per se levels for cannabis metabolites in urine. They don't even recommend THC levels for the blood, because this science is still just emerging. And actually, I skipped over something I meant to ask. Are people here familiar with what a metabolite is? I put it on the screen twice there on one slide. A metabolite is essentially a byproduct when you consume a substance like marijuana and that substance is metabolized. It then turns that substance into certain byproducts. The byproducts may be psychoactive, they may not be psychoactive. And most of the time when toxicology tests are done, they're not looking for the drug, they're oftentimes looking for the byproduct. So it's very important to distinguish between the active drug itself and the byproduct.
Just say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life at Amazon.com or visit potculturebook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. G'day, my smoky friends. We get some kick-ass rock and roll today on the Stash with Scratched Apple. It's time for a revolution, and the boys from Scratched Apple provide us the soundtrack with Songs of the Revolution. We've seen the collateral damage of the drug war, families needlessly torn apart. Today's song is about a young mother who's a victim to this unnecessary war. Scratched Apple is Clay Singletary on guitar, Ducky Medlock singing his heart out, Chris Boone pounding the bass, and Lee on drums. It is time to stand together and demand our government change unfair cannabis laws. Scratched Apple rocks out of North Carolina. Visit their MySpace page and discover more of their amazing music. You can get a link to their MySpace page at our blog at stash.normal.org, as well as an MP3 download of this tune. It's Scratched Apple with Songs of the Revolution.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson, and I need your help. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 20s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stop arresting law-abiding citizens because they prefer marijuana over alcohol. Nearly 2,000 Americans are arrested every day on marijuana charges. We're unfairly destroying the lives and careers of hundreds of thousands of people each year simply because they smoke marijuana. These are not criminals. They're average citizens like you, good neighbors who work hard, raise families, pay taxes, and contribute to their communities. We need your help to end marijuana prohibition once and for all. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORMAL, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
We continue now with part two of Paul Armentano's presentation from the Aspen Normal Legal Seminar on DUID laws.
Okay, so that said, knowing that there is this, there's not a consensus in the evidence as to what per se levels should be, because per se levels for one person might be different from another person depending on their pattern of use. Because this science is just emerging, you wouldn't think we would have states passing per se levels for marijuana. Yet, we do. There are now four states that have set per se standards for marijuana. What that means is that if you are driving a vehicle in these states and you have either THC in your blood above their set standard, or in some cases, like you see in Nevada and Ohio, if you have an inactive metabolite that simply indicates you might have used marijuana at some unspecified previous point in time, you are per se guilty under the law of driving while impaired. You will see that in Virginia, cannabis and cannabis metabolites are excluded from the per se statute. I lived in Virginia when this law was being litigated, and I was in very close contact with my representatives and with the legislature, and it is not a coincidence that I was living in Virginia and in that frequent contact with the legislature that Virginia has cannabis and cannabis metabolites excluded from the state law. Now, you might notice Groten, Herman, and colleagues, when they actually reviewed the on-road accident evidence and they assessed culpability of who was responsible for these accidents in drivers that used marijuana, they found an increased risk of accident only when drivers had THC levels that exceeded 5 nanograms, and they really didn't find a major increase in crash risk until the THC nanogram levels were close to about 10 nanograms in the blood. That's why they set that 5 to 10 potential threshold for per se levels. You'll notice that outside of Pennsylvania, the levels that are here are much lower. That's because Groten, Herman, and colleagues are trying to come up with a scientific standard for a per se threshold for marijuana. The state legislatures in these individual states were not looking at scientific evidence at all. In fact, these standards are actually not scientific thresholds, but they are what we call ability to confirm standards. What that means is when a blood test is taken in, say, the state of Nevada, and it's sent to a state-certified lab, that lab does not believe they can test for the sensitivity of THC in blood below the threshold of 2 nanograms. If they thought they could accurately, the standard would be 0 in Nevada. But because they can only go down to 2, they set the standard at 2, and they call it a per se standard. But it is not a standard based on impairment. It is based on the lab's ability to confirm. The only state where you see a 5 nanogram per milliliter per se standard, which does have some basis in science, is in Pennsylvania. And that is because when the law was written by the legislature, they actually asked the Department of Health to come up with standards after the passage of the law, and the Pennsylvania Department of Health, to their credit, actually did look at some of the science and did try to set a per se standard based on science. That's why you'll also notice that inactive metabolites are excluded from the law in Pennsylvania, while they're included in Nevada and they're included in Ohio. And I can tell you, having worked very closely with this Ohio law, where the original law was set to be 0 THC in the blood and 0 carboxy THC in the urine, instead they got it raised to 2 and 35, which frankly is still almost meaningless, that these numbers, the 35 nanogram per milliliter number, was simply picked out of the sky. There's absolutely no bearing in science or impairment. The legislators simply liked the number 35.
How did that horrible law come out of Nevada politically? What about Michigan?
We're going to talk about Michigan.
You want to combine Nevada?
You know, Nevada's law has been on the books for some time. They're actually the first state to pass a per se standard. How it came out is generally the way it comes out in many of these states. Usually there's an accident, there's a claim somebody had been intoxicated, the police say we can't really track down on this the way we want to, we don't have a law, even though all these individuals could simply be charged under DUI. And the standards were simply picked because of the lab's ability to confirm. At the time, and Nevada's law goes back almost 10 years now, that's what the lowest thresholds labs are using when it came to drug testing. So that's the lab, those are the thresholds they picked. What was troubling about that is you had other states that once Nevada picked those thresholds, other states wanted to follow suit. And so now oftentimes when you have these laws written, They simply use Nevada's standards, thinking that Nevada's standards were based on some science, when in fact they were simply built on that time and the lab's ability to confirm.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with an apropos cannabis quote from the man whose home we visited for a cookout, Owl Farm. That would be Hunter S. Thompson, the famous writer, who said, quote, "I have always loved marijuana. It has been a source of joy and comfort to me for many years, and I still think of it as a basic staple of life, along with beer and ice and grapefruits. And millions of Americans agree with me," end quote. Hear, hear, Hunter S. Thompson. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. More Aspen Legal Seminar coming at you tomorrow. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.